Hi, I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. In each episode, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lenses of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. In today's episode, we turn to one of the most critical challenges for our generation, climate change, and the transition to a low-carbon economy. I'm joined by Vijay Vaithiswaran, who's the Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor at The Economist, to discuss recent policy developments and the role of technology and innovation in supporting the net zero transition. I can think of no better expert for this discussion. More than two decades ago, based in London, Vijay started as The Economist's Global Energy Correspondent, then affectionately known as the Earth, Wind, and Fire Beat. He then moved on to lead the paper's coverage of the broader innovation space, where technology is fundamentally reshaping global economies, and has followed the intersection of climate and technology issues for decades. He's been at all the hotspots, from the early COPs to the rooms where energy companies and political leaders made system-changing decisions. But the key point about Vijay is he's known all the players from the start, and is one of those rare journalists who's become a valued insider in the expert conversation. He's also a friend who I also turn to for smart, insightful guidance on these complex challenges. We begin our conversation by bringing everyone up to speed on recent climate measures in the United States and exploring the linkages between policy and climate tech.
First of all, Vijay, it's great to see you, and twice in 1 week. This is extraordinary, and it's just great to be with you.
Likewise, it's a real treat, Rana.
To begin our conversation, I'd like to set the stage and discuss a recent set of climate measures in the United States, in California and beyond, where I am today. Governor Newsom recently signed a sweeping set of climate measures into law, which will cut pollution and accelerate the state's clean energy transition. On the federal level, the American Inflation Reduction Act included significant incentives to support clean technologies and investment. How do you assess the role of technology in achieving the objectives of these policies? And what government incentives do you think are going to be particularly effective in supporting the generation of and use of clean energy and the adoption of emerging technologies to reach net zero?
So there's two ways to look at the question of technologies when it comes to clean energy, right? First, there is accelerating deployment of things that are off the shelf or close to the marketplace. That's part of the focus of both the federal legislation as well as the California proposals. Very generous amounts of money, tens of billions in California's case, in the federal level, $369 billion coming through that IRA law that you referenced, as well as other money from the infrastructure bill that was passed prior to that, and some amount of money from the CHIPS Plus Science Act as well. So we have a trifecta of flooding the zone with money. And this is a sticky wicket. John Kerry put his foot in it when he argued before the UN summit COP26 that innovation is required to solve the climate problem. He was immediately denounced by a particular group of environmentalists, particularly for whom innovation is a dirty word because they see it as something of a Trojan horse, or even something that oil companies wave the flag of innovation when they don't want to do much on clean energy. They say we're going to do hydrogen and carbon capture 25 years from now. In the meanwhile, you know, don't do anything on meaningful windmills today. That's the dichotomy. That's a false dichotomy. It always has been false. And if it was not false 25 years ago, it certainly is today, because the urgency of the need is so great in order to deal with emissions, to try to rein in the extent of climate change, that we need to do both rapid deployment of what we can now, dramatic scale up of clean energies that are at the ready, as well as investing very heavily on options for the future, be that advanced nuclear, all manner of direct air capture, as well as sequestration, and numerous ways of getting to the pathway of hydrogen and other green fuels. All of those things require bets, and now there's money coming. That's the good news. We can do both. We must do both. And as far as the linkage between the policy and the technology, I think there's strong links and weak links. There's a direct link in the sense that, for example, if you're in the hydrogen game, it's a very expensive fuel to make, right? There's already energy penalties, and making hydrogen People should know that hydrogen is not an energy source. There isn't a magical pot of hydrogen waiting in the middle of Kansas for us to find. It's a fuel. It's like electricity. You have to make it from something. You can make it from dirty things like coal, or you can make it from clean things like some form of renewables or carbon-free nuclear. But you lose energy along the way. But we do it because we need a fuel like that to clean up the dirtiest of industries, steel, cement, other industrial uses, for example, where windmills and Teslas aren't going to get there. You need to have some kind of green fuel. That's the reason we do it. But the price is very high today, given the cost. Well, the American federal legislation gives the equivalent of something like $3 a kilogram subsidy. I've heard hydrogen producers tell me quietly, we're going to have negative costs in our best locations in America. And European and Indian competitors saying, how are we going to compete against this flood of money in America? It's a nice problem to have, right? It's the opposite of the problem we've had in clean tech, where we've woefully underinvested. I predict that we're going to see a flood of money coming as a blunderbuss from Washington through the Department of Energy, through the loan program, but as well through particularly these tax credits and other incentives, that we're going to have to see how efficiently and effectively they sponsor these technologies. But I think there's going to be an awful lot of money coming to deployment of existing technologies, as well as investments in scaling up first pilot commercialization that we will hopefully succeed in, so that the private sector can pick up the baton and run with it.
Talk to me about this flood of money that we're seeing right now. And you're a practical guy, and you've seen many different efforts across decades. And it's probably, this is the first time, you know, in our lifetimes that we've seen this much money deployed this fast. Talk to me about the capacity of that money to get deployed and what you're hearing from industry and where you see the actual take up of this money and where you see some of the challenges in capacity building over the course of the next few years.
I mean, we do spend lots of money, right? So it's not the first time we spent money. We spent a lot of money on pandemic relief. Most of it was good to spend. Some of it was pilfered or misdirected, but we did kickstart a phenomenal innovation engine, particularly with mRNA vaccines, right? And deployed it. And so it is possible to do and worth doing. But that was a very aggressive war footing with a very imminent enemy that had already appeared. With climate, this is more of a marathon, right? Because we have to keep this up for a century, really. And so we have to start now, accelerate, deploy, take stock every year now under the UN process. But really, we're talking a 30-year game with a 100-year end game, in a sense. Not that it will ever end, but as far as humans can stretch our imaginations and planning abilities. In defense, we spend vast amounts of money, more than what we're talking about in climate. And so I just want to give some context to the amount of money we're talking about. The best analyses that have been done on how much investment will be required for the world to really get to a net zero scenario across the economy, not just in energy. It's easy to pick on the power sector, but we need to do this in all industries. We're talking in the trillions and trillions, right? And that's the kind of figures we're talking about over the next 30 years. The IEA, International Energy Agency, has done great work, as have many others. McKinsey Global Institute has done some seminal work on this. The punchline for me from all those analyses is, if you go beyond the amounts of money to say, hold on a minute, what are you comparing it to? The energy industry already spends trillions of dollars and would have in the next 30 years. That's the dirty energy industry. On upkeep of assets, renewal of pipelines, new power plants, and so on. So society is going to spend capital equipment at factories. You know, we know that the industrial CapEx cycle continues apace, whether you think about climate or not. So when you look at the pot of money that was anyway going to come from capital markets and compare it to what needs to be spent, the differential is actually not very much. We're talking about small percentages of global GDP. And over time, there's every reason to think that we'll actually see lower energy prices as the long-term outcome. Again, bear in mind, fossil fuels are ultimately volatile. We see their prices at the moment. Ultimately, it's a limited resource, right? It is something that's stuck in the ground based on bones of crunched up dinosaurs. There's a limited quantity, and it will get more expensive over time to take it out of the ground. Whereas the energy from the sun is infinite, at least for the next billion years, and practically free. So in the long term, we're likely to have lower costs of energy as we overcome that transition. But that transition is what we're really dealing with. And the costs of transition, to me, are the more interesting question. The absolute figures, I don't think there's any problem in absorbing it. The sums are well consistent within what Wall Street and other financial actors can handle.
With this context, we turn to the timelines of the energy transition, both short and long term, and the incentives needed to make meaningful progress.
So talk to me about the short-term game and the long-term game. And I've heard it said that it took 150 years to build the energy system that we have today. And we are embarking on building the same thing twice over in 30 years. And what do you think that the major obstacles are in the short run to get us into the longer game of energy transition, which I think we all agree on?
So energy transitions historically take decades, if not centuries, but that's because they've typically been not been driven by policy, right? They've typically happened just because coal seemed to be more energy dense than wood, and therefore we switched over or better than cow dung and biomass. We know this is a policy-driven transition. It has to happen a lot faster than the marketplace would do it. And that's why if we want to get it right, and as Canada has actually taken a lead on this, we need to think about externalities. We need to get pricing right, get the price signals right, and make those signals economy-wide. And I've argued, you know, 20 years ago, I wrote my first op-ed in the Wall Street Journal arguing for a revenue-neutral carbon tax that was economy-wide for the U.S. Obviously, the U.S. did not do that, but there are still sympathetic ears that support this. And so I think there is a way to do this that would actually send the right signals and ratchet up over time to sending the signals properly. We have to live in a world in which the ideal can't be the enemy of the good. So the U.S. IRA law, which has just been passed, is all carrots and virtually no sticks at all. There is a methane tax, which is actually quite useful. They call it a methane fee. And I think that's actually very good because fugitive emissions from natural gas are a terrible problem. We now understand how big a problem it is. And I think it's actually a problem that we're going to solve within 10 years, if not sooner, because of the way that's being approached with new technologies, satellite observation, things like the methane fee, push from consumers like Europe, one of the biggest places that buys natural gas, refusing to, in a few years, buy dirty natural gas from sources that won't verify fugitive emissions. So we actually can make progress in the transition in the right direction. That can give us big wins along the way, co-benefits. But I think your question is, how do we handle the pace of change when we've never done it before? And I think you get incentives right. We can't do it from government fiat and a top-down push alone. It won't work. So we need to change incentives facing individuals, facing companies, facing industries, facing markets. Because if you mobilize private market, if you show profit in the transition, companies and industries will figure out how to get there, right? If it's more profitable for ArcelorMittal and for Tata Steel to make money from green steel than, let's say, the carbon taxed and otherwise penalized CBAMed steel that they might be trying to import from a part of the developing world that doesn't have policies or ways of getting it to go green, and they find they can't sell steel into the best markets in the world, their best customers, then you suddenly create an incentive for them to invest. And that's what I found. I was recently in India investigating the country's leapfrog on green energy, on hydrogen and renewables, and spoke with the key steel figures. They're not very enthusiastic about green steel. Just to give an example, ArcelorMittal's local division, which is a big steel giant out of Europe, but they have a massive operations. They're about to increase their steel presence by 4x. Their footprint in India is going to increase dramatically in the next 10 years, all in line with economic growth, in line with the other steel companies. And almost all of that growth is going to be through conventional blast furnaces. It's not using any of the green steel routes, the DRI, direct reduced iron, the hydrogen amenable routes, the ones that are electric arc furnaces where you can bring in green power to power it. At the moment, business as usual envisions a repeat of the past, which would be a massive carbon shadow coming from India that hasn't been noticed. We all know about the coal plants in China that are coming. Not many people talk about the blast furnaces coming in India. And so I think that bending the curve, the only point at which the head of the Indian Steel Association was willing to give some ground was, he said, if Europe really implements the court carbon border adjustment mechanism, the CBAM, which is an import tax. If you bring in dirty steel into Europe, you have to pay a hefty tax. Local producers don't have to pay if they make green steel. And America has talked about possibly mimicking that or copying that mechanism. We'll see if it happens. He said, if there really is some kind of CBAM mechanism, then we would have to invest in green steel. Suddenly, you see how if he wants to make that profit, the big pot of European steel profit, he's going to have to go green. He has an investment choice. He can invest billions in one path or the other. He's pretty agnostic. He's not about greenery. He's about the green, meaning about making dollars in his view. And this is how you change those incentives.
From here, we consider the current geopolitical moment. and assess how different markets are advancing the clean energy transition.
How would you handicap right now, sitting in, you know, where we are in the fall of 2022, the various efforts of the United States, which we've seen through the Inflation Reduction Act as the principal piece of legislation, but other acts as well, the European Union, and you mentioned India and China in the midst of this, which are both economies that will set signal and set market in so many ways. Like, how would you characterize the movement of each of these markets towards transition right now in the fall of 2022?
I would say the U.S. has obviously had some forward momentum with the recent wave of legislation, including the surprising success of the IRA law. And I would say it's actually going to be more durable than some people think. It did pass in a highly partisan way. However, the benefits will accrue to many Republican states, that is red states, because that's where most of the wind and solar are, for example. Also, many of the heavy industries that are based in those markets, including the big power companies, the utilities, they all supported this bill, in part because it replaced the stop-go kind of credits that were given for clean energy with 10-year certainty on how tax credits will be done for clean energy. Investors love certainty. And second thing is the cheapest way to make energy around the world in most markets is some form of solar, if not, then wind. It's not new coal plants. And even gas plants, given current gas prices and volatility, are not that attractive. So you're really paying them to do something that they wanted to do anyway. So they're very, very happy to take the money and to ramp up their green investments. And they don't want a Republican Congress to come in and change it. So I would say the U.S. has suddenly gone from a laggard, really one that when Senator Kerry went overseas to talk about and lecture other countries on being green, really had a credibility problem, to one that's turning up with something serious in the bank. Europe, of course, has doubled down with the Russian crisis. I think they're doing it for the geopolitical reasons as much as for other reasons. And the sleeper is really India. I think that though India got a bad name coming out of the last UN conference, we'll all remember the Indian delegate stopped the delegations of all other countries from shutting down coal. They wanted it instead to be phased down rather than phased out, I think was the phraseology. In fact, when you look and see what's happening, you see an enormous leapfrogging kind of growth coming in the clean energy sectors in India and a potential to become a world-leading producer of electrolyzers and green hydrogen. So that's one to watch. China, I would be more cautious about, to be honest with you. Their investments in coal plants, and you see the trajectory of their carbon footprint, it is not changing very much, even though they're a huge producer of batteries, EVs, windmills, panels. That credit has to be given. Their contribution to greenhouse gases through coal plants does not seem to be reducing.
Given Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the coming energy challenges this winter in Europe, how would you characterize the challenge that this invasion has presented to the energy transition globally right now?
There's no doubt that in the short term, it has made things more difficult. We are burning more coal as a result of this invasion than we would have otherwise. Coal is environmental enemy number one. And Rana, as we record this podcast, you can see over my shoulder a poster from an Economist cover that I wrote called Coal, Environmental Enemy Number One, written in the year 2000. And we could run the cover story and briefing I wrote almost verbatim today. In fact, we did last year. A colleague of mine wrote more or less the same story. And that's because Asia's rise has been powered on the back of coal. And guess what? Asia's not finished rising. And Africa is ready to rise and is looking to fossil fuels. That's going to be one of the themes that comes up at the climate summit in Egypt in November, which is known as the Africa Summit. To some, it's being held, of course, on the continent. And one of the themes is African countries, some of them will turn up and say, don't deny us the right to use natural gas, for example. Nigeria has been saying that very vocally, and nor coal for that reason. And so we may very well see a momentum in what I would consider, particularly with coal, the wrong direction. And if it's used temporarily in Europe to keep people from freezing this winter because Russia is cutting off the gas, that's understandable. I think even environmentalists acknowledge it's a crisis situation. On the other hand, if you lock in new fossil fuel assets, that's something that's happening around the world, including in Europe, and including with natural gas plants. Now, generally speaking, natural gas plants are better than coal plants. But once you account for the escaping fugitive methane from the pipelines, especially if it comes from Russia, they're not that much better than coal, to be honest. And the new plants that are being installed will live for 30 or 40 years. Investors will expect a payback. So regulations to make sure that these are future-proofed, which is what Germany's been working on, after 10 or 15 years, making sure that any natural gas plants that are installed out of necessity today can instead be run on hydrogen, for example, or other clean fuels. That's the kind of thing the Germans are actually pioneering, and I think that is absolutely essential. You're not likely to see those kinds of future-proofing regulations in many countries around the world. And so I think we're actually getting a setback. And even something that seems unintended, Europe buying up LNG, liquefied natural gas cargoes, which they have been and they will do even more of this winter. If it's a bad winter, they're going to need all the LNG they can get. The cargoes that get diverted from China, let's say, well, what China does is it fuel switches back to coal because it has extra coal or dirty residual oil and other kinds of petroleum products that are much worse for the environment, both local environment, killing people today, as well as, of course, to climate, which kills people tomorrow. And so that's why I say there are knock-on effects of this crisis that are going to endure, and they're not great knock-on effects in the short term. But longer term, I think it by reminding the world, especially Europe, of the fickleness and unreliability of fossil fuel producers, like Russia today, perhaps OPEC tomorrow, I think it has probably strengthened the resolve of many to double down on a green transition and to pay the price. That it's not, you're not just paying because you're virtuous or virtue signaling, you're paying as a hedge against fossil fuel volatility, against demonstrated bad behavior by fossil fuel providers. You're paying for the geopolitical and energy security that you get. These are all things that countries pay for anyway. People, everyone believes in a strong defense and not being reliant on unreliable, you know, security partners. Well, now think of this as defense spending when you invest in domestic green energy.
With this geopolitical context, I ask Vijay for his views on the role of transition fuels, particularly natural gas.
Some would say that in this transition, I mean, we're in obviously the hockey stick curve part of the transition right now, but traditional fossil fuels are, you know, still not off the table and certainly part of this transition. And that's particularly underlined by the crisis that we're seeing in Europe right now. How would you handicap the prospects for traditional fossil fuels, particularly LNG, as a transition fuel? I know there's mixed debate in industry around this, but the market seems to be indicating that LNG is playing a role.
I have a particular view on this. I understand the concerns expressed by those who are concerned about climate, that if you do natural gas carelessly, as has been done in America's Permian Basin, where a lot of the shale has come from, and continues to be done in a careless way up to this moment, with the exception of a handful of companies that have changed the way that they do business, you release a lot of dangerous methane into the atmosphere. And there's flaring as well, and other techniques and that around the world make natural gas a poor choice. However, we know how to do this better. We now have much better ways of monitoring, measuring, keeping honest a lot of these operators, whether it's satellites, whether it's drones, whether it's on the ground, physical technologies, real-time monitoring. These are in place. There are third-party watchdogs in place, and there are penalties introduced in the US law, in Europe as well. And so bad actors like Gazprom, which has refused to acknowledge its problems, it states that it has about one-tenth the natural gas emissions, fugitive methane emissions that independent experts think that it does, will be banned from selling gas to advanced markets. I think that's how you change this. The reason we need gas as a transition fuel is that the renewables ramp up, however aggressively we go into it, is going to encounter bottlenecks. It's going to get bunged up, as we argued in a recent cover a few months ago. The scale of the ambition that we have for increasing wind, solar, is going to require vast amounts of improvements in the grid, in energy storage, for example, a variety of types, not just lithium-ion batteries as they have in California, but other forms of storage that need to be proven up, scaled up, including hydrogen could be a storage medium that's being tested as well in the ground. All of this is going to require time, and there will be numerous setbacks. Some of them will be financial. If we enter a global recession, that's going to affect capital availability for green energy in the developing world. It's a huge concern. Already, the cost of capital for clean energy outside of developed markets is too high. And it's very hard for those countries to overcome forex risk, country risk, as well as another premium that's attached. We need innovative financial instruments, creative financing from development banks and donors to or maybe philanthropies to get in there with first dollar risk. This is talked about, but nothing yet has concretely appeared. And so I think there are numerous ways that we may see a slower than expected or hoped for transition in clean energy. And in the meanwhile, the default is going to be coal in the developing world. That's just how it is. Look across the developing world. It's often the default. And so I would rather see clean gas brought in there, but with some covenants, with some promises and contractual obligations to phase it out over time as Europe is pioneering. And that's going to require public money. That's the innovation here, that after 10, 15 years, if your gas is not converted or cracked into, say, green ammonia, which is a clean fuel that's a derivative of hydrogen that can be made from gas, and you can run power plants on green ammonia. That's Japan's entire future plan for greening its power sector, is using green ammonia that's imported. There are different bets that people are making, but we need to understand that that transition could take longer and it would certainly be bumpier. What we cannot tolerate is the lights going out and the heat being shut off, as Europe experienced last winter and may very well experience again this winter. If that happens, the kind of popular backlash that we will see, we haven't seen anything yet. We just had a small taste of it so far. It will embolden those who are against the green transition. It will embolden those that say, as OPEC's leaders and the head of Saudi Aramco recently said, I told you so. It'll embolden those that said, you have had premature underinvestment in fossil fuel assets. What you need is much more investment in coal, oil, and natural gas to keep us going for the next 30 years. You're naive. You listen to the Greens, lights are going to go out. And that will sap all popular support for the green transition. So I think we need to be very careful. And natural gas, I think, provides a useful tool. I don't want to, I don't get a dollar from the natural gas industry. That's not why I'm saying this. But I see this with my eyes wide open, that this is a train wreck coming for the green revolution. And, in this world, don't let the ideal be the enemy of the good. It is a good partner to have as a transition.
So don't let the ideal be the enemy of the good, I think, is a great motto for the next months in this. But how do you see, you mentioned the potential backlash, just given the nature of the crisis that is emerging in Europe. How do you see that, if you fast forward the scenario that you just presented, a year from now, 2 years from now, how do you see that impacting the bigger transition that you started the conversation with?
I think if we fast forward a couple of years, in order for me to answer this question, you need to tell me how severe is the global recession induced by the Fed raising interest rates sharply in the next year or two and Britain sinking from leading economy to submerged economy, right? If you can answer, and whether China, for example, will be able to recover from its COVID shutdown induced slump and real estate troubles. If the global economy has a severe setback in the next 2 or 3 years, it's a possibility that it might, in order to get rid of this scourge of inflation, which I think anybody who has a historical memory will remember, it is the worst scourge of the poor. We must deal with inflation as quickly and as effectively as possible, but it might lead to the kind of downturn that makes capital markets more skittish, more risk averse. And then the question is, what will they invest in such a world? And it might be a world which uses less energy than predicted as far as growth rates in the next 2 or 3 years if the world is in recession. Especially emerging markets will be hit particularly hard if interest rates continue going upward. We're going to see a number of economies fall into crisis around the world, emerging economies. And that kind of scenario is not one that the IEA and other sort of green forecasters have grappled with. What do you do if there's a very strong downturn and with retreat of capital markets? We already are entering a venture capital winter and early stage capital. What happens if we see that kind of behavior spread across other capital markets that might be funding the green transition and other kinds of things too, but certainly for our conversation, if we see a risk appetites turn downward, how do we deal with it?
Shifting gears, Vijay and I move on to the role of technology in the green energy future over the next 1 or 2 decades, from batteries and grids to pumped hydro and electric vehicles.
So I think this is the part of the conversation that always gets into the risk on behavior and how, us predicting doom and gloom for the months ahead. But let me shift gears a second, go back to the conversations that you and I have been having for over 20 years about, breakthroughs in this transition towards a green energy future, where there are probably 5 or 10 technologies out there that are going to significantly outperform our expectations. And you have been somebody who, you know, through your hat as the innovation guru at The Economist, have been onto many of these technologies earlier than most. I mean, you were very early on, 20 years ago, onto hydrogen. In fact, it played a big part in your book, which I can see over your shoulder, the first book that you did on this, which was Power to the People. And in that, you made a bold prediction about hydrogen and its role in the energy future. And then, you know, fast forward a few years after that, we didn't hear a lot about hydrogen, but hydrogen is back. And in addition to hydrogen, and maybe you could speak a little bit about hydrogen and its multicolors, maybe you could speak about two or three other technologies that you think are dramatically underrated as potentially significant contributors to the new energy mix 10 to 20 years from now.
Yeah, the time frame matters a lot, Rana. So if you say 10 to 20 years, I think that gives a little bit of a runway for some of the more speculative technologies, right? If you say must have commercial impact within 10 years, then we already know what they are. It's really a dramatic ramp up of existing wind and solar, probably a much bigger expansion of offshore solar, and probably a very aggressive build out of high voltage transmission, HVDC cables, which transmit across very long distances with very low losses. We know how they work. They exist. In addition, things that make the grid more robust, that is, so we don't just have a top-down or a hub-and-spoke approach of sending power from big plants down to distant consumers, but really the vision of Power to the People, the book you alluded to, was that we'll have much more decentralized energy, microgrids, decentralized systems, and we're moving in that direction. In California, for example, almost all solar that's now being waiting for permission from the authorities, 95% of it comes with batteries attached, energy storage. And once you attach batteries to solar, or if you have a vehicle that can, electric car that can do bidirectional charging, which all of them will within a short amount of time, not all of them do today, but they will be, have the capability. You already have a vehicle that can both consume power and generate power and send back to the grid. And so but that's well within the 10-year timeframe. We're going to have radical decentralization of power, and we need the smart control systems. These are things that Silicon Valley is very good at, right? So we already know how to do software control systems. We just don't do it on the grid. We have very conservative, backward-looking regulators, utility bosses, and a 100-year-old paradigm of managing electricity. And that has been slowly upgraded over time. And there are pioneers, there are companies that do better, there are jurisdictions that show the way forward. And in some parts of the world, in April, I wrote a long special report for The Economist on the future of climate technologies, and I noted that we have achieved 100% energy from wind and solar in Australia, in California, in Denmark, in several of the jurisdictions, in Ireland. They've been able to maintain this for some hours or even longer than that. That's not forever, but what that means is that it used to be said you couldn't put more than 10 or 15% intermittent renewables or else the grid will collapse. That used to be the old utility man's rule of thumb. Well, we know that's false. That's not true. We have robust systems now. Germany, they're regularly getting 50% or more in the area around Berlin, which I visited and spoke with the grid managers. They said, oh, yes, we can handle that. And we expect to be able to handle 100% intermittent sources by 2030, for which they're building energy storage and the smart kind of control systems, AI, to manage power. They're connecting with imports of power from other jurisdictions. All of this is stuff that's going to happen in the next 10 years. It's not done widely, but it can be. It's about integration of existing technologies. The next round, which is maybe where your question was going, I would say that the area that has the greatest potential really is energy storage. It's game changing. And the good news here is we have at 5 or 6 different prominent technologies going beyond lithium. I think lithium ion technology, which is currently used at grid scale batteries in Australia, in the US and other countries, is probably not going to be the one we will bet on for the grid because it's expensive. Its inputs are scarce. We know the challenges of lithium. But the third reason is that it has a much better customer in electric vehicles than it does in the grid. The properties that it has and the next generation of lithium batteries are much more likely to be valued by automakers who want dense power, quick recharge, and sort of, you know, a compact form factor, all that. Who cares? If you're on the grid, you can have a big box. It doesn't matter. And you can take a little bit longer to build it. And so we're seeing other kinds of technologies coming up from innovators, as well as, the sleeper play in all of this is hydrogen, which we're seeing experimented for storage. Within the 10-year timeframe, I think these different options could be proven commercially and ready for wide-scale rollout, and a lot of them will fail, and that's okay. But we need to try a dozen of them to get two or three that seem to make sense, and they may make a pumped hydro, which is an old-fashioned technology. India is building more pumped hydro than any country on earth, and the innovators there, private sector companies, and they happen to have geology that favors it, and it's simple, it's not that complicated to do. And if you are able to get it right, there's something called round-the-clock power, 24/7 clean energy. You combine wind in one part of a country or grid, solar from another part of the country or grid, and one can offset the other, but you still have times when neither is functional. You take energy from your storage, in this case, big pumped hydro stations, and that corporates are paying over the odds to be able to say they're doing 24/7 clean energy. Google, Microsoft have said they will do this within a few years. Well, they're already doing it in India, just to give an example how developing countries could leapfrog on something that could be copied in the rich world.
Let me just switch gears to electrification of vehicles. Do you think that the incentives that we have in place right now are going to be sufficient to get us to the 2035 targets? Both Canada and California have some very aggressive targets around that. How do you see this adoption curve going, just given all of the innovation that you've seen in the last, particularly 5 years?
Right. I think you have to see these regulations as something of a nudge and a wink. You know, technology forcing regulations are important, but at the same time, what we've seen historically, and California has been a world leader with technology forcing regulations. I can remember the Air Resources Board, the preeminent regulatory body there, had something called the ZEV mandate, the zero emissions vehicle mandate, where they tried to force basically electric cars to be brought onto the marketplace some 25 years ago. It was too early. The batteries weren't ready, and the GM and some other car makers made a few, frankly, pretty crappy cars that only a mother could love. And they didn't do very well, and they had bad feedback, and they scrapped them in an ignominious way, which led to this wonderful movie, Who Killed the Electric Car, which is worth looking up and seeing as a documentary. But the punchline there was they adjusted their rules, right? And so you try to force, and what happens is a lot of times technology forcing does work. California has a glorious history of technology forcing regulations that led to catalytic converters, low sulfur fuel. And you know, I can go through a range of things that the world now benefits around the world. We just cut and paste California regulations that they've pioneered, but they took their brickbats along the way. They had failures along the way, and they often had to adjust based on market realities, based on the pace of technological change. But by pushing on that, they're able to get there. And one of the outs that countries are using, even though countries like to say we'll have 100% electric vehicles, we all know that they give a carve out for plug-ins. And plug-in hybrids are a cheat, right? Because if I don't want to, I can use my plug-in hybrid 100% on petrol. And so giving me 100% credit for it as an EV is ridiculous. I personally would give 0% credit for any plug-in as an EV as far as a matter of policy. Now, in practice, sure, it's great that you're riding locally and charging every day, but we don't know that you're doing that. And so that's one of the outs that governments can use. And I think up to 20% can be plug-in means you're really only getting to 80%. And in that way, there's a toggle. I'm okay with that. Because what it does is it creates a stick, but it also gives a bit of wiggle room. If it's not 2035, it's 2037, that's fine. What you're going to trying to get that momentum, get the industry to a tipping point where it becomes so unattractive for them to go back to making internal combustion engines the old way. Their supply chains have been broken up. They've shifted over, committed to new factories to do electric vehicles. They've gotten better at it. They've figured out the easy wins. And so that's where you want to get the industry to a point where they have a healthy competition, a virtuous cycle to make more EVs, going beyond the mandate. I think that's the idea. And people want them because they're very well done and they're great cars, not because you're forced to have them. I think we're not there yet, but I think in that 10-year timeframe, we'll find out whether technology is robust enough, supply chains can be made robust enough to get there.
To wrap up our discussion, we consider the role of Canada in the global energy transition.
So, Vijay, where do you see Canada's role in the bigger energy transition and also the automotive transition that's underway? I mean, we're clearly in the midst of making some bold steps in terms of battery critical mineral, the refashioning of the automotive industrial system that has been built up over the course of the last 100 years in North America. We're seeing it rebuilt in front of our eyes. And in fact, some large investments have already been committed into Canada and to its traditional supply chains to ensure that it's a part of this next solution. And critical minerals and the creation of new battery technology is part of the heart of that strategy. How do you see this industry evolving over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, given what you've said about the uptake of EVs?
I think you have a potential in Canada to develop into a clean energy export powerhouse. We can already see pieces of the puzzle. If you look at what Scandinavia is doing, for example, look at Northvolt, look at the battery companies that are, you know, they're heavily funded by European subsidies and government policy support, including, of course, policies to drive EV adoption. But I think this is a moment where industrial policy is back around the world. And if there's ever an area for justification for industrial policy, it is in encouraging the clean energy economy. And so I think you have an opportunity with the vast natural resources that Canada has, energy resources, as well as mineral resources. If you can combine it with something that Canada historically has not had, that is the kind of national acumen to develop cutting edge industries for export, right? It's always been in symbiosis with Detroit that the tier one suppliers, the phenomenal Canadian tier one suppliers have come up. Here, you may need to go and leapfrog over where America is ready to go, or maybe possibly be in frenemy competition with Mexico and the United States on this. But I think because you have those energy resources and mineral resources and need to think about how you calibrate your sensibilities on environmental development, you have a lot of hydrocarbons in the west of your country. So you may be able to do something that Scandinavia cannot, and that is come up with pragmatic policies that might appeal to the world. Whereas what you have in Europe is trapped by its green mindset. And that's partly why it got into that crisis last year, is it abandoned coal, it abandoned nuclear, abandoned gas, and ended up in a place that was not realistic and much worse off. It set back the green revolution in Europe. You have an opportunity to race ahead, but in a way with your eyes wide open, you may well develop a great export industry.
Well, we are practical, BJ, and thank you so much. We're also grateful for your time and your energy. And I know that you do get a chance to spend time, not just in Canada, but also out here in the West Coast. And we look forward to the next time that we could see you out here. And we love to catch you on the pages of The Economist. And whenever you're streaming, we listen in. So from me and from the team, thank you so much for being with us. And look forward to another opportunity to connect.
Likewise, Rana, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. I hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some fresh perspectives. Additional resources are available in the episode show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Vijay Vaithiswaran for being my guest. Production thanks to Marie Elnick, Kate Walter, Augustus Clark, Steph Colburn, Kathleen Speckert, and Olivia Richardson. I'm Rana Sarkar, and thank you for listening. Until next time.